Thank you everyone for joining. I expect a number of people to join as we keep going. We've had about 110 people register for today's session. So I assume as people are getting off calls and grabbing their lunch, they'll be joining us as we go. But thank you for joining us today. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Erin Kuo. I'm the Chief Impact Officer at Impact Investment Group. I wanted to just start off today by acknowledging that I'm coming to you from the Mornington Peninsula, which is the land of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge that the sovereignty over this land was never ceded. And also today to just bring the wisdom and care for land, air, water, and people of all First Nations people into the room and ground us sort of in where we're coming from in the spirit of this work. Okay, I'll just share the results so you can see also who's in the room and what people are looking for. So it's pretty evenly split across the different options that I've given as responses. It seems like many of you are working in impact management and measurement and are here to learn, trying to build some internal capacity and feel like you can do a bit better. And a lot of you want to hear what we're thinking about going forward, as well as our approach and other things. So thanks for that. Just helps me kind of frame how I focus today's session. Okay. So for those of you who've seen the report, what I'm going to do is basically follow the structure of the report and walk you through it. Some of you, I'm sure, have not even opened it up at all and are just here to get the highlights and to have someone talk you through it, which is fine. So we'll follow the general structure and I'll give you some color, some details, some nuances, and share some of our thinking behind it as well. And then, as I said, just feel free to pop questions in the chat and we'll have some questions at the end as well. So I just wanted to start out in terms of framing our thinking and structuring of this report. So those of you who are familiar with Impact Investment Group, you'll know that this is our second annual impact report. I'm assuming all of you know who we are, but for those of you who don't, we're an Australian impact investment funds manager. We've been running for about 7 or so years. And we've been working across a number of different asset classes, predominantly real estate or property, renewable energy, impact venture capital, and now across some multi-strategy, multi-asset class and place-based mandates. Last year, our report, it was much easier for us to think about our impact data structured around investment teams or asset classes. That was where the data was sitting, and it made more sense for us to talk about the impact we were having in property, the impact we were having in renewable energy infrastructure, the impact we were having in venture capital, and then think about our enterprise, our operations, and our foundation. This year, we really wanted to shuffle things up a little bit and bring impact to the heart of what we do and try and think about the systems change we're striving for and think about the investment teams and products and even our enterprise as different tools in the way in which we use finance as a force for good. So we've organized this year's report around 4 different impact themes where we're striving to create change and showing how both as an enterprise at an operational level, as well as through our portfolio, how we drive that change around those different sort of thematics. So I'll talk you through those in just a minute. I also want to start by saying that we know there's no right way to do this work. As all of us know, and it seems like most of you are working in impact management and measurement. So where we were not sure how to bring this together, or there were no sort of templates for us, we just wanted to make sure that we were operating from a place of transparency, honesty, rigor. We tried to be very thoughtful about how we did our calculations, made our assumptions, and if anything, err on the side of being conservative. But I'm happy also just to share our thinking behind any of this if you've got questions. The other thing I want to acknowledge is the year that we've all had, and we were not immune from many of the challenges that we've gone through. And so, in that spirit, I'm incredibly proud of our team and the work that we've continued to be able to do. It's an incredible privilege, but also so salient that in a time like this, aligning the way that we think about finance and the power of investment and how we align that with the world we want to live in, and be very explicit about how that impacts people and the planet. It seems more timely and more important now than ever. And our teams have really shown up and done that work under really challenging circumstances, as I'm sure all of your teams have as well. And it's really made this work on both a personal and a professional level just very relevant. And we've had a lot of really deep reflections and about, you know, issues around power and isolation and, you know, this balance that we're all grappling with in this sector around how we deliver financial outcomes and returns for our clients and private value alongside the social and environmental value that's at the heart of all that we're doing. And in these times, it's particularly challenging. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and really honor my team and acknowledge all of their work that I get the privilege to share with you. So with that, I'll just kind of start to walk you through. This is our executive summary, if you like. So I like to start out by just presenting our theory of change, which is really about our impact intent, or our statement, what change are we trying to achieve? And how is it that we intend to get there? And then how do we measure things along the way? We're so often asked about how do people manage for impact, where to begin. And when we onboard our portfolio companies and our venture capital fund, we start with a theory of change statement. And so I like to just share how we use our own theory of change at IIG. There's no, again, one right way to do this, but I try and keep it as simple and as accessible as possible, which is the way I was taught to do this as a research fellow at the Center for Social Impact. And that starts with a headline sentence. And that sentence is in these darker blue boxes at the top, which says, if we engage and mobilize different types of capital by building impact investment products that respond to problems, valuing what matters, and engaging people, it will lead to more scale and reach for stakeholder, enterprise, and asset level social and environmental benefits, and meaningful changes experienced by staff, clients, communities, and the planet, and ultimately contribute toward creating the next economy that values people, planet, and our connections at the heart of all we do. So one of the ways I was taught to make this something that feels very theoretical and can be very technical and off-putting to a lot of people is to just write a sentence that you could communicate and it can be very clear. I also like to just describe down the bottom how it is that we do that. So I talk about, for example, as you look at, you know, the if we statement, which talks about our inputs, the different types of capital that we're drawing upon, by acknowledging and being deliberate about how we mobilize and use different types of capital and think about that and what we're tracking and measuring is one way that we can kind of match what we measure and what we do together. So everything from our operations in terms of thinking about our operational footprint and the environmental capital that we use, the natural capital, from, you know, green energy to, you know, our carbon emissions to our waste stream, which we've done, you know, audits to measure all those things, to thinking about our people and the diversity in our teams. That's kind of how we start thinking about, okay, what are the resources that we value and that we're reliant upon in order to be successful? Apologies for any background noise. I've got my window open because it's such a beautiful day. So hopefully there's not too much background noise as we go. Just as you move across the sort of impact value chain, if you like, you can see that in terms of activities, we're measured. This is just a snapshot or highlight. This isn't comprehensive. It's just to give an illustration. But we measure both from an enterprise level, things like volunteerism and activation of our staff, to, you know, to portfolio level, the number of deals that we're reviewing, the types of engagement exercises and activities that we're undertaking. Then as we move across the statement, one of the things that we're really proud of this year is as a B Corp, living our values. We last year were certified officially and scored 86.6, which for those of you who are familiar with the B Corp framework and scoring would know that's not the highest score you can get. That's more at the sort of lower end. And what we did is we ran a staff engagement exercise this year to say, what can we do that aligns with the organization we want to become? And what that translated to was increasing our B Corp score to over 100. We'll be recertifying officially this next coming year, but we've boosted our score from 86 to 101, which we're really proud of. And that was largely through employees just saying, hey, what about if we look at, you know, procurement? What if we look at some of our policies? What if we look at our travel? What if we look at some volunteer opportunities and so on? As we move further down the statement, just illustrating in terms of outcomes, we think about our staff, we think about engagement, how they're feeling and different measures there in our staff survey. We think about through our portfolio, the way that people are experiencing benefit and the different outcomes that are resulting. And then when we think about that last box, the ultimate change, often it's much more difficult to measure. And the way that we work through that is because we're really about systems transformation and really proving the thesis that finance can be used as a force for good. We try and track the broader market. So we say, well, how much of the broader market is in impact investing? How many investors are participating in impact investing? And then try and relate that to our proportional share of the market, not that we're driving that change, but that we are trying to understand the bigger change and what's happening. Can everyone hear me okay? I just noticed in the chat someone saying the sound is a little bit off. Can someone just give me in the chat if your sound is okay? Okay, great. Thanks, guys. All right, so next page here is just a bit of summary. Again, at a high level, we wanted, these are the four themes, the impact themes that I was talking about at the start. So where we're really seeking to drive change, and I'll tell you the way we derived, it should say sustainable, by the way, there's a bit of a typo at the top. The way we derived these themes was sort of a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So for those of you interested in how do we land on our themes, what we did is we looked at our current and existing portfolio, which, as I mentioned, consisted already of property, renewable energy infrastructure, venture capital, some sort of multi-strategy approaches. And we tried to go from the bottom up, well, what are these things telling us in terms of thematics? And then when we mapped those to global frameworks like the Sustainable Development Goals, for those of you familiar with Kate Raworth's work on donut economics, looking at the different social and environmental kind of categories that she works with in terms of finding that ring where we can all sustain ourselves and thrive. So when we matched all those different things together and a number of other frameworks, we landed on these four being our core focus and where we think we're best positioned to drive systemic change for people on the planet. And those are around sustainable cities and resilient communities, empowering people, regenerating land, air, and water, and clean energy. And I'll talk you through how we've detailed sort of some data and thinking around each of these sections in just a minute. When we aggregated, this is just the portfolio data, by the way, not the enterprise data. So we wanted to highlight some of the performance statistics across those thematics and then flag how the sustainable development goals that sit most appropriately or reflect those indicators can kind of help structure or frame, for those of you who are interested in the SDGs, the work that we're doing. The other global framework that we draw upon and we align with quite closely is the Impact Management Project. The things that we love about this particular framework is, one, we love that globally, so many practitioners have been contributing towards the evolution of a more systematic, consistent approach across the sector, that we can all start speaking the same language and that we're coming to simpler frameworks that can help even newer entrants into this space to navigate this more clearly. So we've this year just showed how at one level we use the Impact Management Project in many different ways, including through our impact due diligence. But at a whole of portfolio level, just reflecting sort of the HABC or the HMABC for those of you who are familiar. So harm producing may cause harm, acting to avoid harm, benefiting stakeholders, and contributing to solutions. And what we love about what we're seeing through our partners and clients using this framework is that they're able to map their whole portfolio, so not just their impact investments using this typology, and they're able to identify where they've got exposure to harm producing assets or assets where they don't have data and it may be producing harm, and then develop policy responses to say, okay, if it's in an H or an M category, how long will we hold the asset before we engage in an advocacy kind of strategy or a divestment strategy so that we make sure our portfolio is aligning with our values and as best as we can removing from H and M assets to A, B, or C assets. So we like to just sort of reflect for people who are using this framework, how we're also approaching and using this framework in one way. So if you go through the report, what you'll see is each of those four themes has two pages in terms of the section. So for those of you interested in the structure of the report, we're really grappling with brevity and clarity and different types of audiences who like to, you know, have data at a snapshot and, you know, visual imagery, as well as that qualitative data, which I'll show you was the second page where we talk about, you know, three things we did this year and invite a partner or someone within our team to write an opinion piece to really frame where we want to go over the coming year. So in sustainable cities and resilient communities, what you'll see is a lovely photo here of one of our buildings in our portfolio, 401 Collins, which is in the Melbourne CBD. And the thing that we're really proud of with this building is that it's one of only five heritage listed buildings in Australia over 70 years old to achieve the energy performance, energy efficiency performance that it has, which is a NABERS rating of 5.5 stars. So there's only five buildings in Australia that are heritage listed over 70 years old that were able to exceed a five-star energy rating. And our team was really committed to that and wanting to prove that, you know, things like heritage and design don't have to be a trade-off or a barrier to being able to upgrade a building towards modern and high-performing environmental standards. So that was really important with this particular asset. You'll see some other performance highlights here. And those of you who are very familiar with our work would know that one of the things we are known for is the sort of high performing green buildings. Even within the property portfolio, we've been really moving to pushing ourselves onto how we deepen our impact and our thinking while sort of grappling with the realities and certainly the current circumstances. And one of the ways that we've done that is start thinking about people more. So, you know, we've moved away from just the environmental ratings and certifications like your GBCA Green Star and NABERS to also thinking about WELL ratings, so indoor air quality and how buildings are healthy for people and how they impact people. We've also signed an MOU with Launch Housing this year. So it's a nonprofit based in Melbourne that is focused on ending homelessness. And in that MOU, what we did is we've been trying to understand how we get closer to beneficiaries and how we bring the idea of lived experience into our work. So one of the things we were able to do this year is do a volunteer day, an immersion day, where all of our staff were invited to come along, and most of them did attend. We went out into shelters, we volunteered our time, we spent time listening to staff and clients of Launch. In terms of their lived experience. And the idea is for us to start from a place of really listening so that as we think about future products, we're much closer to the human side of the people that we're impacting and the opportunities that are there, and thinking about how do we bring lived experience into our work. So that's where we're kind of progressing on the property side. You'll also see some statistics in here around small business and SME impact, which interestingly in COVID this year, so that's from our Giant Leap portfolio, our Impact VC portfolio. So interestingly with COVID, some of these stats last year felt less impactful, if you like, to some of our stakeholders, whereas in the context of, you know, what's happened with small businesses and certainly for, you know, independent shops, independent grocers, food service providers, that meaningfulness really changed. So their work didn't change, but the world changed around them. So it was really interesting to see how people responded to holding an investment like this and feeling really proud to work with some of these smaller businesses that were providing employment and essential services across the board, which became much more impactful this year. Let me see, I'm struggling to, there we go. So I've skipped the second page of the Sustainable Cities and Resilient Communities, and I'll show you the second page in Empowering People just to give you a sense of the layout. I don't want to talk the whole report in detail through to you, but just give you a sense of it all. In Empowering People, so we think about empowering people in a lot of different ways. It's about amplifying voices. It's about inclusion, diversity, gender. It's about health and well-being. It's really about people. And we think about what our role is to play here. And one of the things that we were really proud to step into this year was this focus on gender diversity and inclusion. So, particularly in light of many of the global conversations around power and Black Lives Matter, and the discourse that's quite divisive and the tribalism that's sort of happening the world over, we felt it was really important to think about what role do we play given where we sit, in terms of being very deliberate of bringing different voices in, making sure that we're doing work with an explicit focus on inclusion where we can. I think it's always been a part of our values, but we hadn't really focused around what does that mean in terms of how we work. So we started with a self-audit, so measuring different things so we could see, do we respond as an enterprise in terms of our own diversity? Are we living our values? You can see here that our board composition, our staff composition at different levels, so junior, senior, and executive staff by gender breakdown is highlighted here. We also measured our gender pay equity, and we did that across the board as well as at different levels of staff as well and different levels of experience. And while we have a 23% gender pay equity gap in favor of men at the end of the financial year, the last 50% of staff recruited reflect a 0% gender pay gap. And we feel that's, you know, something that we're really proud of in terms of reconciling that gap and trying to move towards a 0% gender pay gap. Some other statistics here that are really nice to be able to share. A lot of them come from our Giant Leap portfolio, our Impact VC portfolio. You can see a photo of two of our founders at Work 180, one of the companies in Giant Leap. So that's Gemma and Valeria. And what they're working toward is gender equality in the workplace. So you can see some of their statistics in terms of supporting workplaces to have gender, you know, supportive policies for women in the workplace through their interventions and training. We've also got some statistics here from Applied, which helps to reduce unconscious bias in the hiring process. We've got Academy XI, who's reskilling and training people, particularly in high tech jobs, which again becomes much more relevant when you have the kind of employment statistics we had this year. Down in the bottom, you'll also see some stats from mostly from Giant Leap around some health and well-being impacts in that portfolio. Yeah, I'm getting the question in the chat that we are recording and we'll be able to send this out. So for those of you who weren't either able to make it or have an interruption, we will be able to share the presentation and recording. So in terms of the second page of the two pages of each section, I just wanted to show you an example of that. So we've got here in Empowering People, three things we did this year. So in terms of building relationships and listening, which we thought was a really important place to start, you know, even in terms of our work around reconciliation, for example, rather than jump straight to publishing a reconciliation action plan, which we have been working towards, we felt it was really important first to stop, listen, and build relationships, which can often take more time than publishing a report. So we've spent some time, we've actually engaged an elder in residence, Narwee, Auntie Carolyn Briggs, who's an elder in the Boonwurrung country, and our head office in St. Kilda is in Boonwurrung country. So it's been lovely to have the opportunity to work with her and to engage more meaningfully across our portfolio with First Nations and traditional owners and try and understand what we can do and identify those opportunities. We also took steps to count, reflect, and articulate our objectives. So again, it was hard to jump to what do we do before we understand where we begin from. So, I mean, if we're thinking about gender, even as our own gender equity within our organization, we needed to understand, well, where do our teams sit today? Where is the gender pay equity gap? what are some of the statistics in our portfolio before we can actually introduce policies or responses to how we manage for those things and set targets. And then, of course, we made investments that support people. And Kylie here, who many of you would know, she's one of our venture partners in the Giant Leap Fund. We're really grateful to have Kylie as part of the team there. And she's just talking about how important it is that Giant Leap this year has focused on ways to support different groups of people, and particularly vulnerable people, and why that's important now, particularly focused on people with disability. So each of our sections follows this kind of template, the one page highlight performance stats, and then a description of what we've done, and an opinion piece from one of our partners. Our Sustainable Cities and Resilient Communities partner was Bevan Warner, the CEO of Launch Housing, talking about the opportunity to bring Melbourne to functional zero homelessness. And you know, we're just thinking through what role we can play in partnering with people like that and groups like that. The third theme is around regenerating land, water, and air. Admittedly, this part of our portfolio is where we think there's the greatest opportunity to do more. You can see some of our statistics are much thinner here. We have aggregated our emissions, avoided or abated, across our portfolio and enterprise. We've captured some waste statistics. But what we think is a real opportunity here is to focus more on regenerative agriculture. And we invited Nigel Sharp, for those of you who know Nigel, who works at Tiverton Agriculture Fund, and someone we work quite closely with, to talk about the opportunities in biodiversity and regen ag going forward, and something we're hoping to do more in. And, you know, for those of you who are interested in this space, there's an emerging marketplace for nature being led by the Pollination Foundation and other participants, the Indigenous Land and Sea Council. So some really exciting opportunities coming through this space, and we're hoping certainly to do more. Clean energy. So all of these statistics here come from, at this stage, our renewable energy team. So we've got a couple of solar energy funds and a wind trust. And we have talked about the renewable energy or clean energy generated, as well as what that means in terms of water savings, health and environmental impacts in terms of avoided damage and avoided illnesses as well. In the description section, it's an opinion piece from our head of renewable energy, Lane Crockett. So that's really in terms of our performance, how we aggregated around those themes and tried to keep it to two pages per section. Then in the end, what we tried to do is share a little bit of our thinking. Last year, we shared how we embed impact across the life cycle. And this year, we were really, one of the conversations we had so frequently was around how we make decisions about impact. And we like these global frameworks that are emerging where there's a lot of coalescing around how we do this. So we drew quite heavily around the IFC's operating principles for impact management. We created our investment policy to codify the way we make investment decisions and tried to map to this kind of global framework. Even though we haven't sort of signed on as an official signatory, we feel that following these kinds of frameworks is really helpful for us. And it's helped us to address throughout the investment life cycle, you know, how we think about strategic intent, how we think about ongoing portfolio management, as well as divestment and exit considerations. We acknowledge that we're sort of light on the independent verification at this stage. And I think as the marketplace is evolving, I know our old colleague Josh is probably on the call, or he was registered and he's at Tideline. I know that they've launched a sort of verification product for those who have signed on to the IFC's operating principles for impact management. But the market is still quite thin in terms of where the verification opportunities are in terms of impact data as well as process. So we'll keep our eye on that as we go. We also, as part of that codifying investment decisions, we want an investment policy. We outline in there, and this is something we've shared with other colleagues and partners as well, how we make decisions at each stage of the investment life cycle. We've had to articulate more clearly, you know, your more traditional responsible investment kind of screens in terms of negative screens and positive preferences, largely as we're going through new products, which I'll talk about in just a minute, where we're looking at external fund managers and needing to think about boundary considerations. So not just the fund at hand, but also how they're thinking about in their track record and other ways that they've worked, exposure to different issue areas, and how and when we raise questions and thresholds around our appetite to make investments. The other topic that we felt was really timely to talk about, and we get asked about a lot, is people often say, how do you know there's enough impact? And so I wanted to just share some of the categorical ways that you can sort of think about assessing your impact and thinking about how to introduce a benchmark or threshold of enough. And we do this in lots of different ways, depending on the fund mandate or the asset and the appropriateness, as well as the data. And sometimes it's about thinking about the impact you're having cumulatively over time. Sometimes you may set a benchmark relative to peers in the industry who are either best practice or mainstream. Perhaps, you know, we don't tend to set targets as much, but in the case of gender pay equity, for example, now that we've measured where we are, being able to set a target and then work towards that is really appropriate. Sometimes we think about our threshold as sort of, well, in absence of what we do, it's, you know, nothing would happen. And is that our threshold? You know, certainly considering net impact, the balance of financial returns, risks, and bringing in beneficiary voice and impact according to whom. Just starting to get towards the end of the report here. So I did want to just again reiterate, there's so much to be proud of. I think we're the first ones, like probably many of you as we're doing the work, to be our own critics. So we hold ourselves to quite a high standard because we care so deeply about the work and the impact that we're having. And we always know we could do more and we could do better, and we want to do more and we want to do better. But we also have to stop and acknowledge how hard this is, and make sure that we're very proud and acknowledge the work that it takes to get to this point and continue pioneering this space and this work. We've also found that over this past year, the willingness to use finance as a force for good, so these like kind of why should we do this conversations, are not what people are having anymore. They really want to have the how conversation, but that hasn't really translated in our eyes to reducing the friction between that willingness and the ideas to action. And I suppose, you know, as I sort of make these other points around, you know, yes, we want to be able to not have the trade-off in terms of delivering top tier financial returns with impact. We also want to be able to help vulnerable groups and do deeper impact work. And we are pushing into that space, but we need to find partners who are willing to invest alongside us and with us and work with us to make that possible. We think one of the ways to reduce these barriers is around reframing the notion and around risk and return. And it's really important for us, I think, to start thinking about what we mean when we say market rates. When we say market rates, often I know from doing, you know, the benchmarking impact work years ago and measuring, you know, the financial returns of different products, often there's not even a financial benchmark. You know, you think about unsecured debt, what's the benchmark that we're using in a commercial sense, and particularly when you're talking about risk-adjusted returns. So talking about what is market and how we think about benefits, and it is, I think we can get a lot further if we reframe that notion and think about ourselves as not just, you know, people within our organizations trying to deliver one type of return, but living in communities and families and societies where we're experiencing both the harm and benefit of everything we're doing, the decisions we're making. I'll talk to you in just a minute about one of the products that we're launching, and we're really happy to be putting out into the market. And we're coming out with something called the Impact Alternatives Fund and our second Impact VC Fund, the Giant Leap 2. We're also thinking through how we progress our work with First Nations and, you know, moving through our Reconciliation Action Plan. We're really lucky to be working with some colleagues in New Zealand. I know Jamie's on the call and maybe some others around thinking about how cultural values and applying a cultural lens to this work becomes really inspiring and more meaningful. So we're really excited about that kind of work that we'll get to do going forward. We've been working with other colleagues through our RIA Impact Management and Measurement Community of Practice and others around thinking about gender lens investing, and have started to draft gender principles and a gender policy there as well. So we're excited to progress that work, as well as think about community-led design and lived experience. at some of our assets and opportunities going forward. So in terms of, you know, where we go from here, we really just want to invite all of you to work with us and get in touch. And I wanted to point you to a couple of ways that you can do that. The first way is for those of you who are on this call and looking to have more exposure in your portfolios or learn more about impact investing, register for an information session on our latest product. It's the Impact Alternatives Fund. There's a link there, and I'm sure Dai or someone from our team can send this presentation and the recording after this call. In that new product that we're launching, for those people who haven't done much impact investing, that's really where we were targeting this product. So it was about, you know, sitting neatly within the asset allocation of the alternatives bucket. So less correlation to your traditional asset classes, your listed equities and fixed income, et cetera. So your alternatives asset class, but also a multi-impact strategy. So things like renewable energy infrastructure, impact venture capital, social impact bonds and payment by outcomes, as well as regenerative agriculture. So you get kind of a mixed bag of things. It is a fund of funds, and because there are some IIG funds in there, it sort of contributes to a lower fee structure than your traditional fund of funds. And there's some links also for more information or to download the investment memorandum for if you are interested. We'd also love to hear from you. So whether you're interested in one of our funds, a new product or mandate, you know, we work with WA Super on a place-based mandate. If you're interested in talking to us about impact management and measurement, all the stuff I like to talk about, one way to do that is to join RIA's Impact Management and Measurement Community of Practice if you're a member there. And of course, you know, a lot of our great ideas and deeper impact come from collaborations and partnerships where people approach us around how to activate our solar farms for dance performances or, you know, our properties. We were in touch the other day with the City of Melbourne and some urban planners around a creative precinct in the City of Melbourne and how we can activate some of our properties to create more cultural and creative value. So we're always really interested in those opportunities as well. So that's really it from me. Hopefully, in a nutshell, that gives you a sense of, you know, our performance for the year, the way we were thinking about impact management, measurement, and some of the things we're thinking about going forward, as well as structuring the reporting. So I wanted to try and cover as many of those bases as I could. I'm going to stop sharing now and just see if anyone has any questions. Now, Di, I'm not sure if I need to unmute anybody, but if you've got a question, probably the easiest, if you're struggling to unmute, is just put a question in the chat. Oh, I've got a Q&A box here, it looks like. Okay, so there's a question here. What are the differences between Giant Leap 2, which is our second Impact VC fund, and the Alternatives Fund? So the Alternatives Fund, Tim, is a fund of funds. So we've got a diversified product in there. We have a little bit of allocation to Giant Leap 2 in the Alternatives Fund, but we also have many other strategies and product and managers within the Alts Fund, whereas Giant Leap 2 is our second follow-on sort of Impact VC fund, funding purpose-driven entrepreneurs. Hopefully that clarifies that for you, but let me know if not. There's a question from Kylie. Did you think about how present outcomes achieved by portfolio companies and those that are IIG's own impact? Okay. So I think the question here is really about attribution or contribution. Always really tricky, and particularly when you're one of many investors, as in our Giant Leap portfolio, for example, as opposed to, I think, the point you're making, Kylie, around as an enterprise, we can claim sort of full attribution for our staff volunteerism or our B Corp score, whereas we can't say that all of the impact of our venture capital portfolio companies is ours. And the tricky thing with that is, we thought about this early on. Do we say, well, if we're a 5% shareholder in a company, do we say we have 5% of the impact? And we didn't feel that was appropriate for many reasons, because those things are likely not commensurate. And the role that we play, the type of capital, but also the other sort of relationships or networks that we might contribute, it's not necessarily going to line up with the dollar value. So it was really tricky to say, how do we apportion our contribution or our role? The other interesting thing with Giant Leap is we're typically, to date, have been the only impact VC in the round. So most of the others are conventional or commercial VCs. So we could argue that there's no additionality or contribution, because you'll have commercial money following if we weren't there at the table. But we think that by working with them, particularly around refining their theory of change, their impact intent, their impact measurement, which we do with every portfolio company, we sit down, we onboard them, we go through the data collection process, we work with founding teams. If they've got questions or concerns about, you know, increasing ethical screens on their supply chain, for example, we work with them on that. So we feel like we make additional contributions to help them really progress their impact thinking and their impact management beyond the financial contribution, but so hard to quantify that and report upon that. So I think that's a really good point, that in terms of, you know, additionality, it's quite tricky. The other question I've got here, private debt versus equity, what differences do you see in impact measurement between these two asset classes? So I'm not sure if you mean private equity or listed equity. Those are very, very, very different things. I think certainly in the listed equity space, it's much trickier to track impact management and the definition of positive impact to date. And I know we have a lot of conversations in our impact management and measurement community of practice around how those in the listed space are working through this. In terms of PE and private debt, it really just depends. So I think what we're seeing more in the debt space is how you can work with finance as a tool to link to outcomes and reduce, you know, your interest rate, for example. So we did that with one of our products called the BOLD, the Benefit Outcomes Linked Debt Instrument, where we provided a loan at a certain interest rate to a purpose-driven enterprise. And we worked with a number of other investors and foundations to set that interest rate and then have a discussion about what the outcomes were. So it was for a company called Exceptional that supports people on the autism spectrum being placed into tech jobs. And, you know, we came up with some outcomes around employment statistics, but also the participants' experience of benefit, their perceived experience of the benefit intervention. And the combination of those things, basically, if they're able to achieve certain performance targets from an impact perspective, there we reduce the interest rate down. So some really interesting, I think, innovations in terms of the private debt space. In terms of impact management and the tools available to you. Whereas in the PE space, you know, because you're usually one of a number of investors sitting around the table, you're largely guided by the company themselves. And, you know, the privilege we have is sitting at the table and working with them to refine their approach to impact metrics and impact measurement. It'll be interesting to see how that evolves as we move on. But hopefully that helps to answer that question. I've got another question here about how are we thinking about reporting impact in terms of COVID? It's a really good question. And I know that we had a number of different strategy sessions early on in COVID to say, where's the opportunity moving in this space? And as I mentioned in the presentation, the idea that supporting small businesses a year ago would not really have necessarily constituted impact. Certainly, you wouldn't have said supporting a hospitality business, for example, your local cafe constituted impact. Whereas in the face of COVID, where people were really struggling for livelihoods, as well as a sense of community, the idea of supporting your local cafe, your neighborhood cafe through a community fund was not a crazy, non-impactful idea. In fact, it felt really important to a lot of people. So we recognize that the definition of impact and what was meaningful to people really changed over this period. How much that stays, I don't know. And it's difficult to, you know, I think, as I mentioned, we were really internalizing the global conversations that were raised by COVID around privilege and inclusion and power, and tried to be more deliberate about stepping into how we could meaningfully do more work around that and acknowledge our role to play, without pretending to have all of the solutions, I guess, or completely pivoting the business in a very dynamic kind of environment. So I suppose that's how we thought about, you know, this COVID period, just bringing some of those issues into the light more explicitly and trying to do the work to progress our thinking about that without, you know, changing frameworks really specifically to COVID. Let's see. I've got a question in the chat also. What returns are the various funds delivering? So difficult to answer in aggregate. I think, you know, IIG has been known to be a very commercially focused impact investment funds manager. And we've really been proud of our, you know, sort of top tier financial returns. I know with Giant Leap Fund, you know, as they do their sort of quarterly valuations, they're well in the top quartile of even commercial VCs, not just, you know, not really putting an impact lens on that. So we do try, and part of the thesis of IIG was really about proving that there doesn't have to be a trade-off. I think it's really important to acknowledge that in some cases there is a trade-off, and particularly the cost of doing social work and to support particularly vulnerable beneficiaries, that, you know, we're not all going to see top tier financial returns. But I know the benchmarking work that I helped work on a number of years ago, which, you know, aggregated financial performance across different impact strategies and asset classes. And Jin, the Global Impact Investing Network, picked up that work. And Avalash, who I think was registered, was part of that work as well. Was benchmarking that to investor expectations across asset classes. So you could see, for example, that private debt, impact private debt in Australia, which is hard to aggregate because you've got secured and unsecured and mezzanine and different types of, you know, private debt within that, was delivering, I think, on aggregate over 8%, I think closer to 9%, whereas investor expectations were more in the range of 6 to 8%. So you could say it was sort of outperforming, if you like, even traditional commercial debt. But again, a lot of the devil's in the detail. So I think what you'd see is such a variation in strategies depending on, you know, the impact thesis, the fund mandate, and of course the conditions that we're all operating in. And hopefully that's not a cop out, but just trying to answer the question around the different types of returns that we're seeing. In terms of our view on positive divestment, it's such a good question. And it is something that we have grappled with internally. We've done this in some of our recent deals in terms of property, for example. And I'll give you an example. We had a hotel up in Byron Bay. Some of you may know the Byron Bay Beach Hotel. When we went to sell that asset, there was a discussion, and to be very honest, different people even within the team representing different views, and the push and pull between the commercial outcomes, the beneficial sort of result for our clients, as well as what could we build into the, you know, impact considerations, covenants or conditions of sale. How do we screen potential partners that we might sell to in terms of divestment? We did manage in that particular case to build in a long-term clause. So we had the team prior, you know, many years ago had managed to remove the Pokies machines from the Byron Bay Beach Hotel to reflect community interests and change the sort of feel and nature of that place. That was built into the contract of sale. So we were looking for a partner to acquire that asset who would continue to honor that commitment to the community and not reintroduce that. It's not always straightforward. And I would say where we've struggled the most is probably through our impact venture capital fund. We're lucky that we haven't had to have those hard conversations yet. We've only had them theoretically, not in practice. But we've said, what happens if one of our portfolio companies, for example, starts to breach some of our values, or, you know, has a supply chain issue or an ethical, you know, violation, if you like, that we don't want to hold that company anymore. And we've sort of said it's a really tricky situation, because is selling that asset to just someone else, just passing on the problem, is that better? And, you know, what sort of exit market have we got? So Sometimes it's really tricky to think about the divestment considerations and the divestment options, and of course, balancing the different considerations and stakeholders. What I would say, the way that we navigate that is I feel that our team often does have a robust conversation where we can push and pull. Where it lands is dependent upon decision makers and a lot of different factors, but it is a deliberate step in our process, and we are getting better at making that more explicit in terms of divestment considerations. And that was another question actually in the chat around exit strategy. I think the other thing, just to comment on that, since it is of interest to people, is we're starting to ask ourselves the question, do we start to build in thresholds for impact? Do we have the opportunity to build conditions or covenants into contracts of sale? A lot of that really depends on the asset. It depends on the market conditions at the time. There are things that we are really working through and considering, and it's kind of going to be on a deal-by-deal basis. But we are really interested if others have great frameworks or criteria or policies around divestment that we can learn from. It's something that we're really trying to get much better at because we recognize that the impact is not just to the lifetime that we're holding the asset, but also what happens over the lifetime of that asset after we divest. There's another question here. How do you prioritize different impact areas, environmental sustainability versus diversity and inclusion versus health? And is your allocation of capital reflective of that? So it's a good question, Melissa. I suppose it again is largely reflective of the impact thesis or mandate within that fund strategy or that trust strategy. So when we set up a fund or a trust, we walk through sort of what the impact aspirations and intent are, often what the boundaries are, and again, just balancing all of the different factors. It's hard to speak generically, but I'll say in our real estate portfolio, one of the things we did last year was we were working through a methodology where we haven't really had the chance to apply this in much detail yet, but we spent quite a lot of time and capital kind of testing this theory and this idea, this methodology, where we would acquire a site, we would look at different categories of where there was indicators of health, the picture of health of that asset, if you like. So was there a green space? What was the urban heat island effect? What are the demographics, the employment situation in that community, et cetera? What's the proximity to cultural and creative venues? And once you have a picture of health of that asset and engage with the community and say, what do you guys want to see here? Those two things together, overlaid with financial feasibility, should point you to the most powerful impact interventions. So if we see it's got a really high urban heat island effect and the community is saying, we need a community garden, we need green space, we've got nothing here, and it's been a largely industrial area. Well, then it points us really clearly to a community garden or some green space, and how do we do that? And we've done that at one of our properties, in addition to many other interventions. But it helps us justify those kinds of impact interventions. The other way is thinking about if there's a need for particular tenants to service a community need, putting more value. Sometimes we've even looked at, subsidizing rents for particular tenants to support the value they create for that community. I think it really depends on the asset. For Giant Leap, to give you another example, there are impact themes that nest under the IIG impact themes. And so as we have a mandate, we might use a theme as a hurdle, an impact gate, to say if it fits one of these areas, this is something that we want to progress, change, and make this kind of investment. Should it meet the rest of the impact and commercial DD criteria? And we're often not trying to trade off between, different types of outcome areas, but deliver across outcome areas as best as we can. And even if we've made an investment that's predominantly about an environmental change, we're looking at how do we round that out and progress where there's opportunities to create social impact as well. So hopefully that answers that question. I think that we have reached the end of the questions. Might give everyone just one more minute if there's anything else. Alexander, Oh yeah, I think I answered that question. Okay. Well, I think given we've had quite a lot of discussion, hopefully that gives you some color about our thinking, and our approach to impact and some of our highlights and performance. Really happy to speak to anyone one-on-one in smaller groups. Please get in touch with me, get in touch with our team. Would love to continue the conversation and connect with you over impact management, measurement, product, collaborations, anything. So thanks so much for your time today. And I think our team will be circulating a recording and the slides, I believe, to you as well. So thank you all for joining us. Take care.